I'm Mary Carlson from St. Olaf College Social Work Department. Most people in this room, I think, know me, so I'm not going to say much more introduction, except to say that I've worked for a few years with people with HIV and AIDS, and I currently teach a course in this area, and it remains a very important interest of mine professionally and personally. I'm also going to skip today, I think, some of the basic HIV/AIDS information, because a lot of you know it, but I will just ask whether throughout the week folks have sat with certain questions that are unanswered that you'd like to check with me about anything with HIV or AIDS that maybe was unanswered. I had one person come up and say, I didn't want to ask this in front of the group, but is it possible for a baby to get HIV from the father and the mother be negative? So that's not a dumb question. It's not possible because the HIV is in the semen and not the sperm itself. So for a baby to have HIV, the mom must have had HIV and passed it on to the baby. It can't be the father passing it on. Not a dumb question. In fact, I had to think about it for a minute now. That's right, it's not the sperm itself that's infected, it's the semen. No questions?
Is there anything happy in the research outlook at all?
Anybody else want to respond to that? Anything happy in the research outlook? Yeah, I think a number of things. One is that we have seen that education can work with some populations to stem the spread, the transmission of HIV. I think that unlike any other disease in history, the knowledge that has been generated about HIV quickly is extraordinary. The fact that within two years we had named this virus, and within 3 years we had figured out a blood test for it, is really quite astounding. And I think in light of all the negative and sort of hopeless feelings about this virus changing and mutating and going undetected in some people, we lose sight of the fact that we have really come a long way fairly quickly with a pretty major health hazard for the world. Anybody else have some optimistic, hopeful thing to share about research in HIV? And people care about it. You know, I continue to do church forums, and I continue to teach my class, and every time I think, oh, people are going to be really sick of this. And every time I have full houses and people asking good questions and showing real concern and care about it. So that's hopeful to me as part of the human community. Forget in this room, it's not as easy to see everybody when I'm sitting down, so I'm going to have to stand up. Which is okay. It also doesn't feel as hot today as it was so far. Okay, well, let me just say to introduce today's topic. Some of you may have seen the Newsweek about 2 weeks ago. Which one is it? It's a good thing I put this up. Teens and AIDS has a whole major, probably 10-page article about the issue of HIV in teens in this country. And they talked about a congressional report that came out in April of 1992, which said HIV is spreading unchecked among our nation's adolescents, regardless of where they live or their economic status. I'd like to gear this session not particularly towards teens, which is good because there aren't many here, but for the adults, because I do think that we have as much, in fact, maybe more responsibility to see that this issue is addressed with teenagers in our country as the teens themselves. I did mention that I had a series or a good discussion with the minors and junior minors earlier this week, so we haven't sort of gone without talking with them too. But I think it's important of parents and educators and church members to be doing some of this knowledge building with teens, to be doing modeling of behavior that we think is appropriate for teens to do. So it's not only their risky behavior that we have to blame, it's what we've done or not done in addressing this epidemic in our teens. So one of the first things I'm going to have us do is take a little survey of our own attitudes. I want you to, I probably have enough for everybody here. I want you to take a minute, and you don't have to fill it out necessarily if you don't have a pen, but sort of read through each of these series of questions and kind of consider where you stand on this particular issue. Ignore the marks that are on it. I was hoping they wouldn't show through. The woman who initially gave it to me had marked pretty darkly, so you can see what her attitudes were. But take a couple minutes, if you were, and just think through to yourself where you stand on these particular questions.
This is your turn.
your attitude, do you think 14 year
old? No, I mean, are you saying physically, or is it, I mean, is it possible, or do I feel?
You feel, your attitudes. Your attitudes. Okay, and in just a minute, you're going to have time to discuss it with another person, so
try to think it through yourself. I can only hope.
I had a real strong reaction to number 7, and I must admit, I had to pick that one out.
Mm-hmm. One of the 4 I checked that I thought we should maybe talk primarily about.
What did you react to? How did you feel
about
that? Okay, well, whoa. Sure, I know what that is. Outer course.
Well, and we were just really, I mean, and I realized I got to, and a lot of my abstention in growing up was due to fear. And I guess I'd like to encourage abstention, but not base it on fear. And I'm working all that out.
And by abstinence, you're talking about abstinence from intercourse.
Yeah.
Not from sexual activity or behavior necessarily, or?
Well, I'm not sure yet.
You're working that out, yeah. Well, I think this is real important, because this question really deals with the question of safer sex. And I do say safer, and I think that we've done some disservice in this country by using the term safe sex, because it implies that condom use is 100% safe, which it isn't. With adolescents, it's about 70% safe, because most of them don't know how to use condoms, or don't use them, or carry them around too long in their wallet, and they're not good anymore, whatever it's going to be. So this idea of a range of sexual behaviors that might be appropriate and might be safer than intercourse is something that I think parents and educators need to be talking about. What's okay to do, and when, and how young, etc. Okay, did others of you have questions or issues about that particular item? Did that sort of...
It was really profound to me. I hadn't really thought of that as something we could talk about. Here is an alternative to intercourse. This is something safer. It provides you with an outlet for your loving, caring feelings, but it won't get you in trouble.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think some of us don't consider this as an option?
You've been told.
Oh, it's bad. The
M word. Mine is hair on your chest if you're a woman. Yeah. This is the point of this kind of attitude survey, is to have us, a different generation from the teens, rethink our own questions about sexuality in general, homosexuality in particular, but sexuality in general. And one of the questions is what we were told about masturbation and what we ever said to our kids from age 3 or age 2 when they started exploring their own genital areas and their own sexuality and what felt good to them and what we did about them. I went to a great class that talked about, right now my daughter Rachel is learning body parts. You know, where's Rachel's nose? She says, nose, you know. And how we go all the way down the body parts and we go from about belly button to knees. We do, 15-year-olds. And then, all right, well, this is a message. I have no body. So it starts real young, real early with many of us. So I think we need to be looking at our own hang-ups and attitudes about that. That was helpful to me, and I know this stuff fairly well. Yeah.
With this, I wouldn't really recommend to a young girl masturbation, because it can give her a lot of trouble.
How so? Say more.
Bladder infections and other things that could give her a lot of fear of what she has been doing. But on the other hand, I told my teenage son that there is a safe outlet in it.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But I didn't feel I could do that to my daughter because of what it could, what problems it could be for her.
Not being a medical person myself, I don't know about those particular problems unless woman or girl is doing masturbation with unclean hands or with items that are not clean. Others have a reaction to that?
I haven't heard of that personally, but I'm the central expert either.
Mm-hmm. Anybody more expert than I am? Because I would tend to say that not saying that to a young woman, from my perspective, isn't fair.
I think telling, we have a real double standard about masturbation. Men are kind of just assumed to, I'll do this, and women,
But I think there's a reason for it.
Well, I'd like to see some literature on that to see if there's something.
I'm an overnurse.
Well, I'm a nurse too, but I've never seen any of that in literature that I've read.
And when we learned about that school, and that's many years ago, we learned that girls much more often have bladder infections than boys, and it's as simple as the anatomy.
Well, yeah, it's a hygiene issue.
Yeah, and I think it's just like after intercourse that when we teach young women about intercourse, that we should teach them to evacuate their bladders afterward to prevent bladder infection.
Yes. Can you tell a girl that?
Why can't you?
Can it? And besides, you have fingernails?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it raises good questions and important hygiene questions that need to be talked about. And I think it's good to be looking at how each of us feels separately about this and different. What we tell each of our kids is our right to tell our kids. So it's good that there's some difference of opinion. I think it'd be important to talk with people who maybe have other ideas. You know, if some of you wonder, you can check with the nurses in the group, because I think that's important. Are there others of these attitude items that people felt real strongly about one way or the other, or had some disagreement about? Somebody's chuckling.
Number five.
Oh, I didn't even check that one. Okay. Teenagers should have to live with the consequences of their sexual decisions.
Well, they do live with them, but that doesn't mean that we can't. If it's a bad consequence, we have to support them and help them through. But it sounds almost like an indictment.
Well, you got to live with your decision.
Live with it.
You're on your own. Uh-huh. Okay.
Well, it's sort of just like attitude-driven. Girls that are pregnant, she got herself into that, she's going to pay for it.
Yeah.
You know, that sounds basically the same thing.
Yeah. If you're going to make your bed that way, you need to lie in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Boy, I got nothing to do with it.
Yeah. Boy, I had no connection to it. Okay. What about nine? What do you think about number nine?
I think that's a healthy attitude, if I can.
Okay.
What do you mean, experiment with sex? What does that mean?
How did you read it?
Yeah. I read it intercourse, actually, initially. But if you're talking about,
a range of behaviors.
Kissing, all those things.
I don't
think that's going to happen.
No, I don't think it's unrealistic. 18 or 19? It depends on what kind of activities they are drawn into.
Mm-hmm. Well, if this had said teenagers should be encouraged to wait to experience with sexuality at least till they're 18 or 19, might you read that differently?
Yes.
Or if it said to experiment with sexual intercourse, might you have read that differently?
Yes.
We put sex here for that very reason, to see how you all read about that. Because the word you use with your teens is usually sex, right? You don't get real explicit. I shouldn't say that. I probably won't get as explicit as I should with my children. And I think we need to look at what we say. You know, you gotta not have any sex. You gotta stay away from sex until you're blah, blah age, whatever you think is appropriate. Well, that's a mixed up message to a kid. It's a confusing message. Does that mean I can't ever hug somebody? Does that mean I can't ever touch someone with their clothes on in their sexually arousable places? What does that mean? And we really need to examine our own issues about this so we can be clear with you.
I think the church's study on human sexuality and Christian faith is excellent at this point. So it talks about sexuality as being a given for humanness, so that we can talk about sex without it being what you do under the sheets. And then it talks about genital sexual activity as a specific category of the way you experience your sexuality, so that then when we're talking about experimenting with sex, we aren't talking about experimenting with sexuality, because you've been experimenting with sexuality since you were 6 months. But with genital sexual activity, then there are ways and means and times and places and information that are germane to that that are completely different than the rest of the stuff. Yeah. And if we can help ourselves with vocabulary.
Exactly. And I appreciate you saying that.
Caught up was, I'm sure you will be less explicit with your children than you are with other people's children.
Probably so. Probably so. I absolutely
agree.
I think that's exactly right. Yes.
Well, I'm a health educator, and
I've
worked with lots of young people. I work in another culture, but there's not that much difference. And I had to change my attitude. I may have answered this much differently even 10 years ago, before there was an AIDS epidemic. And I had to get up like she's doing, and I had to start teaching things that were really hard for me to teach. But I thought, if I don't do this,
if I don't say these things and talk about them and learn to laugh about them, because with the kids, it's a lot easier to reduce the tension and do kinds of dynamics or techniques that involve people in this. And I had to change. And so I was telling my compañera here that when I read these things, I know I would have answered them differently before. And I imagine that Mary would have too.
Oh.
Right? I mean, we have to learn to do
I'm
it.
A Lutheran minister's daughter from Minnesota.
St. Olaf's graduate.
It's
a different
world. And we have to learn to be part of that world if we really want our kids to live in a good, wholesome, and holy place.
Yeah.
One thing we mentioned in talking with one another was that, as Dan has been saying all week, sexuality and spirituality were always kept in separate rooms. I mean, you didn't even talk about them in the same conversation. And if we can give our kids the gift of saying we're a whole person and sexuality is a good part of our bodies and our lives, along with the spirituality, and blend those rather than trying to keep them separate.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. And when I talked with the minors, one of the things that came up is that all too often our emphasis is on how we can keep healthy as individuals. And I want my daughter to stay healthy, and so I'm going to tell her what to do to stay safe. The part of my message also needs to be what she can do to keep other people healthy, and that respecting another person's body and spirit and mind is all a part of that wholeness. And the minors, the way they were talking, you know, they know a lot, and they were saying we have some responsibility to see that the human family stays whole and healthy, and that means watching out for each other, not just my health, and so I don't get HIV or other sexually transmitted diseases. So I think that's a very important connection to make. Okay, let me move on just a little bit, because what I wanted to do is start us thinking about personally where we sit with sort of sexuality and homosexuality a little bit for teens as something to sort of go into some of the more statistical data a little bit, and then we have one more case study to look at. Currently in the United States, there are about 8,600 teens ages 13 to 24 in the United States with full-blown AIDS. I think it's sort of interesting that we get up to age 24, but in this culture, we sort of have extended adolescence in many ways, into the college years, right? A lot of you have kids coming home again at 25, 35, 25. So that's how the CDC has elected to keep some of these statistics. And in a minute, you'll also see another reason for that and why it's important. Out of that 8,600, about 3,600 are still living with full-blown AIDS, people this age. AIDS is the sixth leading cause of death for people in this age group in this country right now. 20% of the persons with AIDS in the United States, 20% of the 220,000 people who've been diagnosed with AIDS, are ages 20 to 29. Extending this out a little bit. The reason that's important to say that one-fifth of all cases of AIDS are in that age group is that most of them were probably infected as teens. It's a statistic that gets a little bit hidden, that if you have full-blown AIDS in your 20s, you probably were infected sometime in your teens, late teens, perhaps early 20s. The rate of full-blown AIDS in this age group has increased 77% in the last 3 years alone. Increased more than three quarters in the last 3 years alone. Males, though they make up about 49 to 50% of the population, in this age group they make up about three quarters of the people with AIDS. So it's about 4 to 1, male to female, with AIDS in this age group. Though the girls, the young women, are catching up. As of this year, they're about 40%, and men are about 60%. So it is increasing in the younger women population. A number of national studies have shown about 1 in 500 college students are HIV positive. That varies, obviously, depending on where the college is located, the kind of student that comes to that particular college, but it's an average national statistic. About 1 in 300 applicants to the Job Corps, the United States Job Corps, is HIV positive, based on certain studies. And those are people in this age group and age range. Let's just look a minute at the exposure categories. Any little pointer here, probably, but... they vary a little bit. If we split up the ages 13 to 19 and 20 to 24, let me just go over them briefly. About a quarter of the
of the kids or the young people in the age range 13 to 19 who have full-blown AIDS, this is, got it by homosexual sex as a risk activity. 1/4 of those folks. We think our kids aren't sexual, often. 13% through intravenous drug use as a sole risk factor. 31% from hemophilia. Now this is going to be less big as time goes on. Lots of these kids were infected in the early 80s prior to the blood products, the factor for hemophiliacs being tested and treated. 14% heterosexual sex as a risk activity solely. 14% in this age group. 6%, what does that say?
Oh,
transfusions?
That's right.
4% homosexual activity and IV drug use, or AV drug use, we're not sure which one or the other. 7% is unknown, and I'd remind you that that's the category where we can't get information about risk activity, either because the person has already died, refuses to answer, or gives confusing answers that it's too difficult to tell, or that the person was lost to follow-up. We found out they had AIDS and then we couldn't find them. They moved or they were homeless or something. So that's a fairly big percentage. But if you keep those in mind, 31% hemophiliac, 25% homosexual activity, 13% drug use. That's not quite accurate in terms of space. 14% heterosexual. That should be a little bigger. I have to do this fast, sorry. Okay, in the age group 20 to 24, it's a little different. You can see 54% of people in this age group with AIDS have as their sole risk factor homosexual sex, male-to-male sex. I honestly don't know about female-to-female. I suspect there are extremely few cases here. This is male primarily. 17% IV drug use, slightly higher than in the younger ages. 11% heterosexuality, slightly lower than in the lower ages, primarily because of the increase here in homosexuality as homosexual behavior as the risk factor. Hemophiliacs, 3% only. Probably because a number of these folks who got infected early, who would have been, reached this age, it took a long time for that to show up, and they were probably some of the least severely affected hemophiliacs, and so had less risk associated because they had fewer transfusions of blood products. Transfusion here of other blood, not hemophiliac related, 1%, unknown 5%, and homosexual activity and IV drug use or IV drug use is 90%. Gives you an idea sort of how it has switched over time. Some of the causes of HIV spreading rapidly in the adolescent community, particularly in recent years, I just want to talk a little about. One in the areas of risk-taking are prone to do. In the area of sexuality, studies have shown anywhere between 64 and 70% of seniors in high school have had intercourse. Anywhere between 64 and 70%. Greater in some parts of the country, obviously lesser in other parts. Many of those kids who talk about having intercourse have had a number of partners. A number of them say, I've had both male and female partners. Most of them said, I knew nothing about the history of my sex partners. It's not something I ask about. It's too hard to talk about it. A number of studies recently have shown up to 25% of adolescents have had rectal intercourse in an attempt to avoid pregnancy and to preserve virginity. So we're giving this message. It's very important that you stay a virgin, so girls have intercourse in the rectum instead. 25%, it's a shocking statistic to me, too. I mentioned earlier the failure rate of condoms with adolescents is estimated to be about 70% as opposed to 90% in the general adult population, primarily because young people don't always know how to use it, or the condoms they use are old and ineffective, or they just use them some of the time, part of the time. Drug use is a big risk-taking activity in young people, including steroid use. That can be a risk factor for HIV. There have been young people, athletes who use steroids who have shared needles, passed HIV that way. Alcohol use, let me just read you from a study. This was a National Adolescent Student Health Survey conducted in 1987 across the country about various sorts of safety and lifestyle issues for teens. They found that 77% of 8th graders and 89% of 10th graders say they've used alcohol. Of all respondents said they've used it before or during the 6th grade, but 31% of all respondents had used it before or during 6th grade. 26% of the 8th graders and 38% of the 10th graders reported having had 5 or more drinks on one occasion during the past 2 weeks. Now, why is alcohol use risk-taking for HIV?
Impairs decision-making.
Okay, impairs decision-making. It also, as we found fairly recently, can impair the immune system functioning biologically. Alcohol can reduce the immune system functioning. So we have sexual risk-taking behavior, we have drug use, we have alcohol use. Then we have just this general sense of invulnerability. Very typical comment that I read from one young woman is, well, I'm practically a virgin. And he couldn't have HIV because he drives a really nice car and I just had lunch with him. That's the kind of thinking we all engage in. This is not just them. If you remember where we were at 13, what risks I took at Holden Village when I was here as a college student, which I would die if my daughter ever took. Up on the mountains, you know, no ice axe, I can do this, no problem, no, it's not going to affect me. Gets to be deadly in certain situations, certainly with HIV-related situations. Last but not least, education programs that we have done in the schools and with adolescents have shown, and I mentioned this earlier in the week, that students know a lot about HIV. They know how you get it. They know how you don't get it. They have improved, in fact, their attitudes about HIV. A lot of young people would say, sure, I'd sit next to somebody in school who had AIDS, or I'd play on the same sports team, no problem. Yeah, I think they should be allowed in school. We're a little ways past Ryan White, thankfully. However, does it change their behavior? Not very much. Mm-hmm. Also, our education programs in many places have been pressured not to include information about homosexuality or homosexual sexual activity, have not included information about condom use, or if it does, what they say as the health educator or somebody says, condom use will reduce the risk of HIV. And teens know that. On a piece of paper, they'll say, yes, condoms will reduce the risk. You ask them, do they use condoms? No. Do they know how to use them? No. Have they ever seen a demonstration? No. So we have some holes, personally speaking, I think, in our education programs about HIV. I realize it's a hot issue and we can get into it a little bit. Okay. Mm-hmm. Questions about that before we go on to our next case study? Just some general adolescent stats. Okay, what I want to do next is on the other side of your sheet, is a hypothetical, though possible, situation for any one of you in this room, probably, that was written by Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota AIDS Task Force. What I'd like us to do, and I'll read it out loud again for the sake of the tape, but I'd like us to split up into groups and talk about what you would do as the lay leader to respond to this particular situation, or the minister, provided we have some ministers, and we do in this room. Why don't we have you split into groups right at the moment, like groups of three, four, something like that. Would you do that quickly, and then I'll read it.
Concern.
Concern?
Hurt, yeah, hurt.
I'm sorry, what was it?
I hurt.
Okay,
you
hurt.
I don't feel hurt in the sense of, you know, how could you do this, but I hurt for.
Okay, empathetic reaction. Okay.
Confused.
Confused. Okay, we'll come back to the other reactions that cover everybody pretty well.
Compassionate.
Compassionate. Okay.
I want to fix it.
Okay. Fix it response.
Fix it.
Maybe why she came to you, because she's hoping you might fix it.
I would think about her parents too.
Okay, so that might be concern for other people involved. And okay, and might that come out of your own reaction as a parent, wondering how you respond if this was your child, perhaps? Okay. Okay. Related to these, what are the issues that came out of that? Why were people confused or concerned? One is the effect on parents or families, right? In probably this girl's situation and maybe the IV drug user situation. I mean, there's a lot of ripple effect that comes out of HIV. What about some of the people who are confused or scared?
Lack of precedent, lack of knowledge.
Okay. Let's say lack of knowledge is ignorance. And what was your first one? Lack of precedent. This hasn't happened before. To you particularly, it's a new question. Like, oh geez, now what do I do with this?
It was brought up in our our group. Well, now, just how much information is she looking for? Does she just indeed want to know where she could get an AIDS test, or does she want to listen, be a critical listener?
Okay, so one of the issues is, how you're going to listen or what her needs are, right? What she wants from you. And maybe an action that flows from that would be what?
Just give her the phone number of the health clinic.
Okay. First you might ask her, right? Yeah. What does she need? Number one caveat of social work. What is the client requesting of you? What does she want you to do? And then if she says, give me a number for testing or something, you can give resource. Okay, other issues involved here? Under this confidentiality. Seymour Ruby, why is that an issue?
Legally, you are bound to the law of not telling anyone about
this person.
About when you know in our state.
Okay.
Does that vary from state to state?
Yeah, and what you're talking about is confidentiality about knowing HIV status, right? In this case, we don't know HIV status, right? However, the issue of confidentiality is big. This girl is trusting you with this information about her friend, or you suspect perhaps herself. So what that might cause some confusion, some concern about parents. Do you go to her parents? Do you ever talk with her parents?
You recommend that she goes to her parents.
Okay, one of the actions you might do is suggest talking with somebody else, right? Be a parent, or I heard some groups say, you know, I know somebody in my congregation who knows how to deal with this, do a referral. How do you feel about referring her on to somebody?
I think she's
great.
Not about
the best thing you can do. Okay, best thing you can do, it's what she needs.
You better listen first.
Okay, better listen first. Okay, a couple things are happening here. This girl has come to you, she's probably quaking in her boots to talk to any adult about this potential fear. If the first thing you do is listen carefully, empathetically, internally, confusedly, scaredly, however you're going to listen, you listen first, she will feel accommodated, attended to, listened to. Then I think it's crucial, and it's important for each of you to figure this out for yourself, if you're not the right person, to talk with her a bit about how you have some ignorance about this, or you're not sure what might be the best route, and you know somebody, and is it okay with you, the girl, for you to refer, or would she be willing to come with you, perhaps, to talk to somebody? I agree as a social worker, and you all make your own decision, that you first must listen. Because if you refer on, say, here's a number, the likelihood of her telling to somebody else is pretty low. Particularly true for teens. But for a lot of people coming out about this potential risky behavior, I think it's important to listen first. And then not be an expert if you're not an expert. Don't pretend to say and do something you can't do or don't know how to do. Okay.
And biases, too, would be really important if you're just not comfortable with it.
To be honest about that.
About it.
Yeah. How might you say that?
Say, you know, this is something that I'm struggling with or I'm still working on for myself, where I'm coming from, and so I might not be the best person for you to really listen and help you objectively.
Okay.
To be able to reflect back your
be answer. Honest about that, because they'll appreciate that. You might first, even before saying that, say, I really appreciate the fact that you even talked with me about it. If you don't appreciate it, don't say that. Chances are, however, if a teen's going to come to you, she is coming to you because you have some empathetic listening skills or compassion already that she has sensed. And for you to initially say, I'm sure it takes a lot to talk about this and I appreciate it. Now, I may not be the best person for thus and so reason, and is it okay if we talk together with somebody else or do something else? Okay, other actions that you might do, what did you decide you were going to do besides that? Anything else? Somebody's talking about testing over here.
Here are the numbers that she...
Okay. If she's worried and wants to take an HIV test, give her the numbers. Would you do any more than that?
I'd probably go with her.
Yeah. Offer to go with her, maybe? Okay.
I think that would be a great fear. I mean, she's coming with us.
That might be really a difficult thing to do in this kind of a situation, though. Mm-hmm. You know, you might not have that option. She might be from another part of the state. And you are there, and you're going to say that you're going to take her.
We think that she's probably from the same church, and we're at a retreat together.
Probably from
the
same church.
We know each other, and we have some connection.
Okay, and would you take her without telling her parents?
See, that's a big problem.
Yes.
What if I said she was 12 years old? What if I said she was 18? Does that matter?
Children, children are legally entitled to this after when they can conceive her, you know. In our state.
Yeah, and I don't frankly know state by state laws about this, whether teens are allowed to get the HIV test without permission of their parents. In Minnesota, they are.
Yes, they are.
And they can get it anonymously if they go to certain clinics. In other words, don't even give their real name. They give a fake name or a number. But you need to know that where you live. One of the hopes I have out of this exercise is that you all go back thinking, geez, before I leave a teen retreat, I just want to know what's out there. Okay, we just have a couple minutes left. In terms of what's out there, besides the public health department and the public health clinics, and maybe your doctor's office, if you know your doctor, or the hospital, what resources do you know about within your own churches or synods around HIV or AIDS? Do you know of any? People be willing to share them? Would you go to your pastor? Do you know people in your congregation who do HIV AIDS counseling or testing or working with folks?
In our particular congregation, we have at least two school nurses who are members of our congregation who deal with a lot of young people, and I would think that would be an excellent resource.
Sure, people with expertise both in this age group and perhaps in sexually transmitted diseases, HIV, health concerns for youth. And it might be wise at some point when you go back, if you care about this and you think you might ever find yourself in this situation, to put a note in a worship bulletin or on the bulletin board that says, who do we have in our congregation who feels competent or willing to talk about this with our youth? Is there anybody? They may come forth, they may not. If they don't within your own congregation, what might you do? Check with a synod? I would. A lot of synods have been very active, particularly the West Coast synods, the Midwest synods have done a lot around HIV and AIDS. In Minnesota, we have designated synod experts, for lack of a better term, I can't think of what they call them, sort of synod contact people about HIV and AIDS. And it might be wise to know who that person is. Yeah, any other suggestions or reactions there?
Oh, yes, that my pastor, I wrote myself a note, my pastor would know of other churches, pastors, resource people in our community that would be focused on AIDS and HIV.
I suspect youth ministers have probably spent some time in training or education about this. I would hope so, but there's no guarantee necessarily. So I encourage you to think it through a little bit. Those of you who are here at Holden and came to this session on a really nice day, I suspect you care a great deal about the young people in our churches and in our families. One way we can care about them is to know what's here, to know where we stand with our own attitudes about sexuality and homosexuality within the teen population, and then to impart that in a way that we think is appropriate and helpful. So I'm going to let us go on time for once. Thank you very much.